Amen. Not only are we winding down the last couple weeks of the semester, but we're also winding down the last week or several days of Jesus' life. We're in Mark chapter 14. We've just come off of Mark chapter 13, one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible. But we're in the context, we're in the flow, we're in the river of conflict between Jesus and the Jewish elite. In particular, we've had five different scenes over the last two or three chapters of conflict between Jesus and the Jewish elite. Mark chapter 11, 27 through 33, Jesus' authority is questioned right after he cleanses the temple. They say, "By what authority are you doing this?" To which he then responds by saying, "Let me answer your question with a question. What authority did John the Baptist do his ministry?" Can't answer that. I won't answer you. Then Mark chapter 12, 13 through 17, you have the second major conflict after the parable of the tenants. The Pharisees then launch a question asking, "Should we pay taxes to Caesar?" And we already talked about how Jesus answered that. The third conflict, then after the Pharisees fail, is the Sadducees in Mark chapter 12, 18 through 27, where they ask a question about what? Marriage at the resurrection. Something that they didn't even believe in anyway. Just trying to set a trap for Jesus, see if they can trip him up. After he successfully navigates through that minefield, the fourth interaction or conflict is Mark 12, 28 through 34, where the Pharisees, technically it doesn't say the Pharisees in the text, but a teacher of the law, launches a question about what is the greatest commandment. And Jesus not only answers well, but the guy's response almost makes Jesus think this guy is pretty close to converting. If he just knew who I was, then all of this would be good. Then we have the fifth conflict. Right after that, Jesus then launches his own counterattack. They've attacked him several times. He says the conflict is not going to end on your terms, it's going to end on my terms. And he launches an attack, asking the question about the relationship between Christ and the King of David in Mark 12, 35 through 40. So the tension has been building over the last two chapters. Then we have chapter 13, where Jesus takes his disciples aside and he gives them this incredible prediction of the destruction of the temple, followed by a prediction of his second coming. Now remember, chapter 13, it is revolved around two primary issues that the disciples have conflated into one issue. They think the destruction of the temple and the end of everything, the soon teleia, all of that will happen in one moment. And Jesus says, there's a problem with your question. These are actually two separate events. So he takes the first 30 verses or so, 31 verses, and he says, let me talk to you about the initial event, the destruction of the temple. And then in verse 32, signaled by the periday in the Greek, but concerning the second coming, verses 32 through 37, he then says, now let me talk to you about the second coming. What is the key difference between these two events? What is the key difference that he articulates in chapter 13? The difference between the destruction of the temple and the second coming. Lots of signs. Yeah, which one has lots of signs? Destruction of the temple. You will know it's coming. You, he keeps using that word over and over and over and over. You, disciples, will know this is going to happen. Maybe he says, remember, I have told you this in advance. So be careful. Look out. Be on watch. It should be very clear to you. There'll be false messiahs. There'll be wars. The whole world will be... You'll see the abomination of desolation. You will see this. It'll be very clear. And then you come in verses 32 through 37 and what shifts? You won't see. There are no signs. It's going to happen so suddenly. You just got to be ready. How do you be ready? By what you do. He says, you know, the first coming I came and no one was ready. Because what did I find? Oh, I found the temple being used as a den of laestes. That's what I found. He says, don't make me, whenever I come back, find you in the same way. Be ready now. How? By what you do. By who you are, by what you're dedicated to. Two different events that are very distinguished. Number one, that is imminent and it has signs, the destruction of the temple. And number two, that it is not imminent. It will be a long time away and there are no signs. It's just going to happen. Both of them, though, can be considered, we talked about this, a new creation. Because this is so politically cataclysmic that an upheaval of this size, the destruction of the temple, is so overwhelming that it can only be compared to a brand new creation. Whenever the entire temple is wiped out not to be reestablished, that's a pretty big shift in the kingdom of God. Almost as significant as moving from time into eternity. Both can be considered a new creation. One of the reasons why this is called heaven and earth passing away is because the temple is referred to as heaven and earth. And this is heaven and earth passing away because it literally will be heaven and earth passing away. How do you know which one he's talking about? Context, friends. Context. Is this making sense? Are there any questions about that before we dive into chapter 14? Because I know I wanted to give you guys more time to process chapter 13. It's been a week or so. You may not even really care about it anymore, although it's a great chapter. Nothing? Crystal clear? Totally good? So I could do the whole test on that chapter alone? You'd be fine? We good? No? Yes? Maybe I will do an essay question. No, I won't. Yes. Say it again. Yes, how do I know whenever he says heaven and earth will pass away? How do I know he's talking about the temple there? Well, because the first 30 verses were all talking about the temple. Therefore, I could say he is shifting. But if I can see that heaven and earth also can apply to the temple, why would I need to shift contexts? The way when I shifted context, though, is in verse 32, whenever you have the but concerning, the peri day. All of a sudden, he's saying the topic has shifted. It's the same linguistic tool that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians. But concerning this, a drastic shift in context. Topic. Yeah?
Would the disciples have known that he was talking about the temple there too? Or would they have no idea? Would they thought he was talking about the end of the world or destruction of the temple?
What do you mean by that?
Would the disciples have that confusion, kind of like we do today, on what
Antioch
was talking about?
The disciples would have picked up on the Greek, the linguistic things I was pulling out much easier than us. And the disciples understand the difference between a suntaleia and a telos. Our problem is it's the same word in English for both of them. It's end. Well, what type of end? See, all the little different shifts. Matter of fact, Dan and I were discussing this via email. A lot of the different shifts that I have to go through and meticulously point out to everyone is something that would have been in the disciples. It would have been as clear as me talking to the disciples about 9/11, you know, to you guys. Is this making sense? It would not have been difficult for me just to say stuff like, yeah, and then the two towers fell. But you can't just say twin towers in every context and everybody understand what you're talking about. You've got to have some sort of frame of reference with which you could actually deal with. And what that's called is a common grammar. When you don't have a common grammar with someone, be it symbolically or actual language, it takes a lot more work to actually piece together the situation, the scenario. But with the disciples, they have all that framework in mind. Therefore, whenever Jesus talks about the abomination of desolation, they not only think of Daniel, but they think of the other time in which an abomination of desolation occurred in the 2nd century BC involving the temple. What's his name? Antiochus Epiphanes. See, so a lot of the different things they're downloading in their mind, because it's at the forefront of their mind, we don't have the forefront of our mind. What do we have at the forefront of our mind? Tim LaHaye's book. And so what I have to do, what my job is, I feel, is to say we need to pull back all the gunk that we have that's laying on this text so that we can actually possibly see what they were seeing through their lenses. And so that's why it takes, you know, a lot of, everybody follow me. Remember how I was doing that for the 2 days straight? And the reason why is because it's so easy for us just to completely miss it and jump off because we've got so much baggage that we're carrying to this text. Tons of it. Matter of fact, the Matthew 24 chapter is even worse. Matthew chapter 24, verses 40 through 41 is that famous passage where it says, two will be walking in the field, one will be taken, the other's left. Two women will be grinding at the millstone. One will be taken, the other left. And we think, oh, the rapture. Problem is that in context, the people that are taken are the evil people. If you read it in context of Matthew 24:36, it says it'll be like in the days of Noah. Whenever Noah, they get into the ark and all the evil people are still on the earth and they're swept away. So it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two will be walking in the field, one will be taken, the other left. And you ask, in the days of Noah, who was left on the earth? Who was swept away? See the problem? So in Matthew 24, there's even bigger contextual issues. In Mark 13, he doesn't even bring up the two are taken, one's left. I wish he did. We would have been able to talk about rapture a little bit more, but he didn't, so we can't. But you see the point? The disciples wouldn't have been hearing that last part and going, oh, he's talking rapture. No. The word rapture wasn't even uttered in the church until 1830. Very first time. A woman by the name of Margaret MacDonald in Scotland. Before that, no one had a concept of a rapture. So no, they wouldn't have been struggling with the same things we're struggling with. However, does that mean that I would say that now they totally get how the kingdom's going to be established? No. Because in Acts chapter 1, verse 6, they show clearly they don't get it. Now is going to be the time that you're going to establish the kingdom back to Israel? And Jesus is like, hey, you know, what is wrong with these people? I just spent the last 40 days talking to them about the kingdom. And they asked me this question. I hope the Holy Spirit does a number on them because they're obviously not listening to me. So no, the disciples would still be dense. But I think it's one of the reasons why Peter, in retrospect, made sure this chapter got into his gospel that he's preaching. Now he gets it. Why does Matthew bring it in? Because now he gets it. Is this making sense? Why does John not bring it in? Because all of Revelation's about the same issue as the Olivet Discourse. It's just on a big, broader, weirder scale. It has dragons crawling around. I love this time of year, by the way. We've got our nativity scene up with my little dragon in the back. My poor son. This is totally irrelevant, but my poor son came to me the other day and he's like, Dad, were there dragons at Jesus' nativity scene? I said, well, you know, there was the dragon. He goes, I was trying to tell my cousin and he totally didn't believe me. I said, buddy, just know you're more theologically accurate than him. He's like, okay, I guess I'll go back to the fight. Anyway. All right. Mark chapter 14. Any other questions about 13 before we move on? No? Okay, good. Oh, damage control. Okay. That actually reminds me of another story. This would have been about 2 years ago. We were at Orinoco and they had their nativity scene set up on the stage and he's sitting there, Isaac Shade, he's one of the worship leaders at Orinoco. Zion's like, hey, where's your dragon? Isaac's like, what dragon? I'm like, forget it. I'm like, just he knows Revelation too well. Okay, anyway, Mark chapter 14, a bunch of conflict. That's where we're at right now. Jesus exacerbates the conflict in chapter 13 by describing the destruction of the temple in pretty vivid terms, something that nebulously refers to in chapter 11. Nebulous is too strong of a word, but more veiled. But now chapter 14. Now the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away. From a Jewish perspective, from a Jewish lens, what does that phrase mean? Let me read it again. Now the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away. If you're a disciple of Jesus, what are you thinking? What is? Somebody say something? I thought I heard whispering. Say it again. Maybe recognized. New deliverance. Think about how Jesus just came into Jerusalem in chapter 11. He comes in this incredible donkey procession. People are screaming out, save us, O God. For the king has come. We will lay down our own lives to fight. And we will be victorious because God is our king. And now they're 2 days away from the Passover. From the day which celebrated the moment in which all of Israel was taken out of the grips of the empire of Egypt. That's the day, the Exodus. 2 days away. And the disciples are thinking, liberation's a-coming. It's coming. We're going to be set free. For the Messiah will be revealed. For the Messiah will take hold of the sword. For the Messiah will set us free, will liberate us. 2 days away. And the chief priests and teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. The very things he has been indicting them for. The very things. chapter 12, we get the parable of the evil tenants of the vineyard. And what does he say they do with all of God's servants? Time and time and time again, they beat and kill him. They even took one and struck him on the head and killed him too. And then he sends his son. And what do the evil tenants do? Hey, this is the son. His inheritance is up for grab. Let's kill him too. And he says, and this is why the kingdom's going to be taken from you and given to somebody that'll bear its fruit. And they say, oh, you jerk, I'm going to kill you because you just said that about us. Like come on. That's the whole point. Nevertheless, they look for a way to kill him, arrest him and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. See, they don't care when it comes to ritual purity. That's kind of the irony of all this. In a minute, Jesus is going to be on trial. What they're going to convict him of is blasphemy, of violating the laws of God. But man, if it comes to protecting their honor and their positions of power, they'll throw the whole book out to get what they want. Because the end will justify the means. Ooh, that's never a good thing to live by. That is never a good thing to live by. Oh, the end will justify the means. Well, at least my point was made, so it doesn't matter if I steamrolled the whole church. Well, you know, that person needed talking to, so I'll add that line in my sermon and just throw a bomb out in the middle of everything. The end never justifies the means. It just doesn't. The means is the whole point. That's the whole point. How are you living? The means is where ethics lives. And Jesus, I think, cares a little bit about that. Otherwise, I'm not sure why he's so upset and throwing. I just thought of the vintage 21 Jesus clips where he walks in, he's cleansing the temple. I watched those the other day because my Christology class brought it up. He's like flipping over the table. There's this one, that one. What in the name of me is going on here? Otherwise, Jesus, why is he so upset? Why is he so mad? If ethics means nothing, if the way you live has absolutely no impact on what Jesus, you know, considers your impact to the kingdom being, then what's he so mad about? Matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 23, what he gets all ticked off at the Pharisees about, is he says, man, when it comes to tithing, you do it down to the very smallest spices. But when it comes to the more important things of the law, like justice and mercy and forgiveness, you guys ignore all of those. And they look for a way to kill him. But not during the feast. We don't want the people to get upset. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table of the home of a man named Simon the leper. That's actually the only time in the entire Bible we even get this guy's name. That's the only time. We don't even really know his name. Or we don't even know his story really. But you can piece some things together. Why do I think Mark puts this in? Because it builds a contrast with the ruling elite of verses 1 and 2 and what you're going to see in verses 3 and following. For what you find in the first two verses is the Jewish elite, the home that they dwell in, the home that they cherish is the temple. Where you find the King of Kings dwelling in is the home of a leper. You know, the Jewish elite, they're rubbing elbows with the people of prominence, the high priests, the teachers of the law, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the one that ruled the temple. And Jesus is hanging out with the outcasts. Jewish elite are plotting their ways at advancing their kingdom through violence. And what we're going to see here, the rest of verses 31, is the central key issue will be how Jesus is going to advance his kingdom through having violence done to himself. So why does he throw in Simon the leper? Because I think Mark is saying, do you see the difference between these kingdoms? It's about as clear as you can, as possible. It's clear as day. What they're fighting for and what they value is just not what we're fighting for and what we value. Who they hang out with and who they fight for themselves is not who we hang out and fight for. For the King of Kings, a couple days before he's going to bring liberation, is hanging out with a leper. Probably in a home that used to be condemned. And now, that's where you can find him. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, A woman came with an alabaster jar, a very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. A couple things are weird here. Mark leaves out some huge details. And I think he's got a reason for it, but he misses some huge details. Number one, Mark does not tell us who she is. We don't get her name. We never do. We do in John chapter 12, verse 3. In John chapter 12, verse 3, the person that is mentioned is Mary, the sister of Lazarus. So it is possible that the actual reason why she has this expensive perfume was that it was intended to anoint her brother at his death. But because Jesus raised him from the dead, she doesn't need it anymore. Nevertheless, it's still anointing someone in their death. And that's what Jesus will point out here in just a minute. Very expensive perfume. Mark doesn't tell us how expensive it was. Why? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But John chapter 12, verse 5 says it was worth a year's wages. 365 denarii. A year's wages. Then what we'll see here next in verse 4 is she leaves out some more important details. Mark is a boy. Leaves out some important details. Some other ones. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. Mark doesn't even tell us who gets indignant and why the person was really indignant. But John does. John chapter 12, verse 4 says that the person that makes this objection, that voices this problem, is a guy by the name of Judas Iscariot. And then in verse 6 it says, Judas did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Oh, well, that's nice. I'll be the treasurer. Keep giving it to us to support the ministry of the King of Kings, and I'll just keep buying myself really expensive meals. But Mark never tells us this detail. Why? A couple of things. First of all, let's look at the objection. This objection is actually a good objection. It actually makes sense with what Jesus' ministry has been moving towards so far. They're in the home of Simon the leper, aren't they? And a lot of Jesus' ministry has been focusing on the outcast, focusing on the least of these. As a matter of fact, in Matthew's gospel, this event happens right after Matthew chapter 25, where the last parable, the fourth parable that he speaks in Matthew 25, is the separation of the sheep and the goats based on what? The way you treat the least of these. And this event would occur right after that. So technically, the objection is accurate and consistent with the ministry of Jesus. It's almost like for the very first time, this disciple is kind of getting what Jesus has been selling. No, we're supposed to fight for the poor. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that is true. You got the message right, but there's something you're missing. What is missing? What are they missing? What's the key message that they are refusing to accept? What's that?
His identity.
Yes. His identity, particularly the death of the Messiah. You see what's happening? Jesus agrees with the poor argument. He says, I get that. But don't you understand something bigger is happening there? What is happening in this moment is not a waste of perfume, but it is the preparation for my burial. And he says, the reason why I think Mark leaves out all those details, leaves out the details of Judas, leaves out the details of who it was, leaves out the details of how much it was worth, is because Mark doesn't want you to miss the issue. Because the issue is not about how much the perfume cost. The issue isn't about Judas Iscariot necessarily. The issue is about the identity of the Messiah. The one that must be killed, must be betrayed, the one that must die to let go of the poor, or to help to liberate the poor. The one that must die to gain victory. Leave her alone, verse 6, said Jesus. Why are you bothering her? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them anytime you want, but you will not always have me. Let's stop right there for a second. Unbelievably, I have had people use this verse as an apologetic against serving the poor. Oh my word. Well, Jesus even says you always have the poor with them, as if just because there will always be a problem, we shouldn't be involved in it. One of the problems there is that we always think in terms of investments. Of if this won't render a high dividend or a return, then why would I be involved in it? Because that's what the church does. We lavishly spend things on people that the rest of society says it's a waste of time and money. It's kind of like what Shane Claiborne says. My wife reminds me all the time. I think we need to get taken advantage of more often. We're so worried about being taken advantage of. And that's just silly. You're supposed to be taken advantage of. Does not the Son of Man get taken advantage of on some level? Of course people are going to take advantage of you. You're the church. We've not been called to be good brokers. We've not been called to be good investors. Am I saying be a bad steward? No, I'm not saying be a bad steward. What I'm saying is if you've never been taken advantage of, then you're probably not being benevolent enough. My word, I should be able to count on both my hands and my toes how many times I've been taken advantage of. And maybe even have some I never even knew. Apologetic against serving the poor? Really? After everything that Jesus' ministry has done for the first 13 chapters, chapter 14 is wherever I'm going to try to undo all that with one phrase? It doesn't make any sense. But people will use that. And that's when you look at him and say, is that really what this passage is about? This passage is about ignoring the poor? No. The passage is about this. Something bigger is happening here. Something bigger is happening here. It is the death of the Messiah that is about to occur. And you really want liberation for the poor, you got to give them both. We're dealing with a paper this afternoon in my Christology class on liberation theology, and I really don't have a liberation theology problem. It's just whenever people misuse liberation theology. But a lot of times the people that misuse liberation theology are not the liberation theologians. A lot of times it's the people characterizing the liberation theologians. Because Gustavo Gutierrez, which is one of the founders of liberation theology in the 1960s, he looks at him and he says, it's a both and. He says, what we have down here in Latin America is people thirsting for the righteousness of Jesus, as well as hungering and thirsting for actual food. And he says, I want to give them the food so that this hunger can be satisfied. He says, but I pray that this one never will be. He's not asking for one or the other. He's asking for a both and. And that's what liberation theology is founded on. It's saying, no, we cannot cast out the spiritual, but there doesn't need to be a dichotomy. This is the thing that blows my mind. People are like, well, should we feed their mouths or their souls? Really? You can split somebody in half like that? That's unbelievable. I mean, I usually look at the person and say, the person that's usually telling me, we need to just feed their souls. I said, tell me that statement just with your soul, not using your body, and I'll believe you. Oh, you can't separate the two. Believe it or not, what you do to someone's body can affect their soul, and vice versa. So why not just do both? I don't understand why I have to pick one. Stop making me pick one. I want to do both. Did Jesus do anything different? If my ministry is going to be social justice, then I can only deal with their bodies, because that's what Jesus did, right? Did Jesus have anything to do with social justice? I think so. He's hanging out in Simon the leper's house. Socially, there's justice occurring in that moment when the king comes into the outcast's home. Yet, did he only have to focus on one or the other? No. Anybody that says, I'm going to focus on just their soul and not their body is a fool. And anybody that just says, I'm going to focus on just their body and not their soul is a fool. Because every person is all of it. They don't just need a piece of bread. They need the bread of life. But they don't also just need their soul to be focused on. Because a lot of times, they won't even hear you. You really want to get people's attention, both those that are hungry and those that are not, you know, very well fed in our country, start serving the least of these. I was talking to somebody, this went a while back, I don't remember who it was. It may have been Jay St. Clair. But he flat out said, he goes, I'm convinced that our methodology of evangelism. I'm not going to blame this on Jay because it may not have been him. I'll blame it on me. He said, or the person said, I'm convinced that our methodology of evangelism may not be as effective as what it could be. Because a lot of times, even in church planning, this is definitely me. A lot of times, even in church planning, the principle is go after the rich people first. Jesus never did that. He always went at the poor first. And it got the rich's attention. One of the reasons why we've got a bunch of rich people, and yet not many, yet a lot of them are missing the mark, is because we're also not bringing in the key aspect of the poor. You want to get to the heart of the rich? Start spending more time with the poor. I believe his evangelistic methodology makes perfect sense, and yet makes no sense all at the same time. How can I sustain a church without having the people that are rich? Yeah, that's a good question. God's a little bigger than that question, but that's a good one. I understand the practical reality of that. I get it. But I'm not going to shy away from it, from this truth of, man. I know we'll always have the poor with us. I know we will. But that's not an out for you not to pay attention to them. It's not an out. It's kind of like saying, well, people will always sin, therefore Jesus shouldn't die on the cross. How does that make any sense? Yeah, Scott.
As far as letting people take advantage of us, where would you draw the line enabling?
At the cross. Shane Claiborne was asked this question once in a Skype session with my Christian Life class. A person asked him, they said, when we're giving that money to the poor person, how do we know they're not just going to take that money and booze it up and get smokes and all this stuff? And actually, C.S. Lewis had a funny answer to that. Yeah, I'll tell that story first, and then I'll do the Claiborne one, because that one's funny. C.S. Lewis was walking with one of his buddies, and he saw a poor person there, and C.S. Lewis just emptied out his whole pocket of money, and his friend was like, you know that person, he's like, that person's probably going to take that money and go spend it on booze and cigarettes. And C.S. Lewis looked at him, and he said, I would have too. Anyway, but he's English, you guys can't do that. So Shane Claiborne was asked the same question in the class. The student said, how do you know the person's not going to go spend it on drugs? How do you know the person's not going to go spend it on booze? How do you know the person's not going to go spend it on etc.? And Claiborne says, two answers to that. Number one, do you ask those same questions about the CEOs of Walmart? Because they do some pretty atrocious things too, but we don't feel like we need to be held accountable to that. He said, number two, if you knew the person, if you knew them, you would know what they were going to spend it on. Problem is, we don't want to take the time to get to know them. We just want to throw something out the window and keep going. He says, learn their name, learn their story, and then you'll know that maybe their daughter named, you know, Mariah needs a new dress. Because the one that she wears to school every single day is ratty, torn, and stinks. And if you knew what it could go to, then you wouldn't be asking, your questions would shift. The only way you know if you're enabling someone is if you're actually involved in their life. But the problem is we want it easier than that. We want to just be able to write a check and send it to an organization. We want to just be able to throw something out the window and make ourselves feel good. But the bottom line is Jesus is hanging out in Simon the leper's home. He didn't just throw money at him. He went and lived with him. So the only way you can know whether or not you're enabling someone is if you actually know their story. You actually know their struggles. And then you can answer that question. But that question cannot be answered if you don't know. So my response back would be, change the way you look at the poor. Change the way you interact with them. Don't just throw money at them and think you've done something good. Get involved in their lives. And I'm telling you, that's way harder, way messier, and way more like Jesus. Other questions on that? It's amazing how the early church basically perpetuates itself by focusing primarily on the poor. It's pretty astounding. I've referenced this book several times, but Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, he documents how this occurs over 300 years, sociologically, even taking the supernatural out of it. How could something like this take over the whole empire? And the answer that he comes up with is they love the least of these better than anyone. And people were just attracted to it like a moth to a flame. What is this? Who are these people? I'm glad you asked. Yeah, we take advantage of Jesus all the time. You know, I'm thankful that he's willing to be taken advantage of. Because otherwise I'd be in a heap of trouble. Protecting my investment. Whoa. I don't even understand that word in the Christian context. Protecting my investment. No. You just invest. Even to the point where you're hanging on a tree, you just invest. In people that just don't even deserve it. Because who around him at this point deserves what he's about to do? Who around him deserves it? Be taken advantage of. It's a delightful thing. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. See the issue? Jesus is saying, the key thing that you're missing, you're actually starting to get some of the ethics right, paying attention to the poor. He says, but if you don't have me and my identity and who I am as a key part in that, then even all the ethics in the world, it's not going to help anything. He says, the key point is I am a crucified king. And you're refusing to admit this. But this isn't the first time Jesus brought this up. As a matter of fact, this is what, the seventh time now that he's brought it up? Mark chapter 8, 31 through 32, right after the great confession. Mark chapter 9, 9 through 13. Mark chapter 9, 30 through 32. Mark chapter 10, 32 through 34. Mark chapter 10, 45. Mark chapter 12, 1 through 11. Consistently, Jesus says, I have to die. I have to die. They're going to kill me. I have to die. But I'll raise again. I'll raise again. And the disciples are saying, silly Jesus. You don't need to die. You're the king. I tell you the truth, verse 9. Wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Ironically, we don't even get her name. In Mark's gospel, ironically, we don't even get her name. But what has she done? Prepared the king for burial. See, what the disciples are missing is not benevolence. They actually are getting that some. Although we use the very thing of benevolence in this passage to undo our own benevolence. What the disciples are missing is who Jesus is. Verse 10. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12. Notice the scene that comes right before the betrayal. Notice the scene right before the betrayal. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. At this point in the narrative, if it wasn't for Mark chapter 3:19 in passing where he says Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed Jesus, we'd have no inclination that Judas would be the one that would throw Jesus under the bus. He just hasn't really appeared in the gospel very much. It's just not really on the radar. And then just out of nowhere, the audience would be going, whoa, we've heard this story before, but that comes out of nowhere in the narrative. Judas, why did Judas betray him? Why did Judas go to the chief priests and betray Jesus? I think it has something to do with the scene that just occurred. I think Judas said, no, the king will not die. As a matter of fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set up something where this tension we've been building, where you will be forced to fight. What if he was doing that? What if he was saying, I'm going to put you in a situation where militaristically you have to fight back. And then you as the king will exalt and will bring Israel along with it and will destroy our enemies. I'm going to put you in a position where you have to accomplish that. And ultimately puts Jesus in a position where it fulfills exactly what Jesus has been talking about the whole time. Where he dies. But why would Judas do that? Because Judas is committed to the lens of the Jewish kingdom. Judas is committed to the violent lens of the Jewish kingdom. It must be established through violence. It must be. Now, people could say, therefore, Judas was just ignorant. No, Judas is doing the same thing that Satan was trying to do in Matthew chapter 4. The same thing that John was trying to do in Mark chapter 8. Make Jesus into a different Messiah than what he truly was. And that is damnable. And that should be a very clear warning for us as well. You make sure that the Jesus that you're preaching is the Jesus that we find in the Gospels, and that you don't eliminate things or eradicate things for your own convenience. Because altering who the Messiah is supposed to be is the key issue that Satan was trying to accomplish in the temptations, that Satan was trying to accomplish through Peter, and that Satan was trying to accomplish through Judas. As a matter of fact, I even see this Judas temptation of Satan possibly as a last-ditch effort by Satan to get Jesus to do what he wanted him to do, and that is bow his knee to Satan's kingdom through using the violence that he had at his disposal to destroy the kingdoms of Rome and to basically the Jewish elite as well. And Jesus says, but that's not who I am. That's not the Messiah. That's not the kingdom I'm establishing. So I don't think Judas was just, you know, a product of his circumstances. I think Judas is showing he is committed to making Jesus into the Messiah that he wants him to be, which happens to be the same Messiah that Satan wants him to be. And that's never something you want to be fighting for. Okay? So I'm not pronouncing his innocence. You hearing me there very clearly? I agree with John whenever he calls him the son of perdition. He is a son of hell. Because ultimately he is doing what his father is having him do, making Jesus into a violent Messiah. Verse 11, they were delighted to hear this. Of course they were. They didn't have any other way. And promised to give him money. But we don't even know how much in Mark's gospel, because it's not important. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover? So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house he enters, the teacher asks, where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there. What does that sound like? What does that remind you of? What? Yeah, it kind of reminds you of the donkey, doesn't it? Kind of a weird moment where you don't really know if Jesus is using supernatural knowledge, if he's made preparations before, or something's happening strange there. I think, honestly, we don't have any answers about this scene any more than what we do with the donkey. Nevertheless, I think he intentionally phrases it in that way to make a connection between the two. Because ultimately, the passage that connects the donkey scene and this one is Zechariah 9. Zechariah 9 will become huge in just a moment. I think the way he introduces this scene is to once again bring up that passage in our minds so that we will understand what Jesus is referring to once he starts articulating clearly the Lord or the new covenant. The disciples left, went into the city, and found things just Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. Ooh, do I need to stop? Yeah, we'll stop there. We'll pick up verse 17 tomorrow. We'll put all the Passover at once. All right, love you guys. See you in the morning. Memory work.